right. Welcome to Planning Commission tonight. Thank you for being here. We're glad to have our applicants and public here. We will move to public comments. If there's any comments that are not pertaining to agenda item, now is the time for that. And with no public comments, we will move into agenda item 3, consideration of a conditional use permit for Hank's Garage at 405 North, 400 West. And Mr. Johnson is the applicant. And Mackenzie.
All right, the applicant is with us tonight. His name is Wesley Johnson. So this is a conditional use permit for 405 North, 400 West. It is in the manufacturing distribution zone, and we're treating it just like we treated the other reception center in the city called Arco Iris that we went through in 2020 and then again in 2022. But essentially, we have classified them as amusement, gambling, and recreation industries with the use of all other amusement and recreation industries. The property is, there's two parcels, and Mr. Johnson owns both. He actually owns all of the ones that are in yellow on your screen. So the area that's outlined in red is what he currently uses for his personal garage for all of his cars. And it was also constructed as an event space for him to have personal gatherings, things like that. It has a mezzanine with a bar, tables, things like that. And then there's a big open warehouse style garage down below that you could have tables, chairs, etc. So there is a easement that currently runs along the northern property line to get to the back parcels, because we by code require that every parcel or every lot in the city has an access from a public right-of-way. In order to make their parking stalls work as engineered by Intellis is to shift that easement so it's closer to the buildings than it is to the northern property line. So we maintain the access easement and get the parking. The applicant is currently working on that with the county, and I think even though I did make it as a recommended condition from the DRC that the existing access easement be relocated through the county to allow for parking on the northern property line. The parking that the engineer was able to put on to all three of the properties is a grand total of, I have it here, give me one sec. And I'm clicking buttons on accident. Do you know how many parking stalls this is, Wes?
78.
78. Okay, so 78 parking stalls. When I calculated the parking based off of the code, I came up with them requiring a minimum of 78 as well. So they're right there, and they're providing the ADA stalls. The DRC didn't have any concerns with this parking plan, nor did they have concerns with the amount of parking based on the square footage, the use, and the location of this property. I feel comfortable saying that even if parking were to overflow onto the public road, it's not heavily trafficked and it's very unlikely, especially on weekends and nights that events would be happening. But we don't plan on that. That's why we parked it up to code. The DRC is recommending, though, that the applicant stripe all of the stalls and sign them according to ADA guidelines and things like that prior to me signing off on the business license. So the applicant is also still working with the fire department and with the building department on making sure that this space is usable per code for their stuff. Here are some pictures of what the mezzanine looks like and also what the just entire garage looks like. The cars are remaining. They've become almost a decoration in this space. So when I was calculating the parking percentages and requirements, I only took the usable space. I didn't do all of the stuff around it. And then here's an example of one of his personal events. I believe this was his birthday party. I feel like he needs to invite all of us to one. So the DRC is recommending approval of this conditional use permit with the two conditions I mentioned before regarding the easement and the parking stalls.
Great. Thanks, Mackenzie. Are there any questions for staff or the applicant? or discussion amongst the commission?
Sorry, I have a question, Commissioner Stone. So is this a event space that can be rented out by the public, or is this?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it'll become, right now it's a private event space where he's having his personal parties, hosting luncheons, things like that. He will be making this a commercial type of venture where he will be renting it out as a reception center, essentially.
Okay. I have a question about, so I noticed there's a bar. Is there, like, what's the, like, or is there, does he need a liquor license? Does he have a liquor license? Did they just, I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, so he will get a license through us to sell liquor, correct, Sherry?
So the DABC or DBA, whatever they are.
They changed their name. DABS.
Some acronym. Some letters, some alphabet soup, something. So there are catering and event licenses that they issue. And essentially, you get local consent from the city council.
That's what it is.
But the division issues those permits. And depending on the type of permit you get, usually what it means is once you get the license, then you have to hire a licensed bartender
who operates
the bar and make sure that the area is secured, that the people are all ID'd and that they are overage, that sort of thing.
So it is a letter of consent to allow them to sell on the property or to provide on the property, which goes before the city council. And we've done those before for restaurants like R&R.
And Arco Iris has that very
Arco
same
Iris.
Thing.
Okay. And that's why we're so familiar with it, is because recently Arco Iris came through as the event center. And we actually had to work directly with the DABC at the time. And so when this application first came through and the DRC first met on it, I did notify the applicant that we would require him to work with the DABS. And I know he has, because our code enforcement officer specialist who quit right before I came back from maternity leave, she actually took a job with the state with DABS and was the one to respond to his case. So
okay.
He's actively working with her on getting all the licensing and things like that. Am I correct in that statement?
So then I assume though, like, privately contracting through that kind of, it's easier than like if it's a restaurant or something.
It's as easy as a restaurant,
relevant,
I would say.
Yeah. I think they're pretty equal in our city as far as how we permit them.
Okay. Cool.
And it does go before the city council. Any other questions?
We can move to a motion if we're ready for that.
Commissioner Jorgensen, seems really straightforward. I move that the Planning Commission approve the conditional use permit for Hank's Garage at 405 North, 400 West, with the following conditions. One, the existing access easement be relocated through the county to allow for parking along the northern property line. And two, all parking stalls must be painted and signed according to the approved plan prior to issuance of the business license.
Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen. And do we have a second?
Commissioner Holbrook, second.
Thank you. And any discussion or comment on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? And motion carries. Great. Thank you. Thank you. It looks like a great place. All right. We will move to agenda item 4, consideration of a conditional use permit for over 30 feet of driveway at 1025 South Plum Tree Court. Mr. Cook is the applicant. And Mackenzie.
All right. Mr. Cook is in attendance with us today in person. This is a property on Plum Tree Court, which is a planned unit development with a private street. They have approximately 287 feet of frontage on this lot. This picture is quite deceiving. It is very large. All of them are on that little cul-de-sac. It's in the R110 zone. So per code, the city code allows for a conditional use permit for driveways greater than 30 feet up to 40 feet and allows lots with a frontage greater than 100 feet width to provide two access driveways for a circular drive. This applicant came through a while back and actually constructed the property with three driveways, one 40 foot and then the circular with two 13 foot accesses. So per code, they are coming to us for a conditional use permit for that 40-foot driveway. They are allowed to have the two round driveway accesses because of their frontage. So it's already been constructed. They have to replace the damaged driveway that is part of the circular one, which you can see in the top corner of this slide, before we release the bond that we take whenever we get a building permit. But aside from that, they are constructed and constructed up to code, to our understanding. And the Development Review Committee is recommending approval of this conditional use permit with no conditions, because it's meeting all requirements for proximity to property lines. It's on a private road. And yeah, this one's pretty straightforward. It's more of a technicality that our code requires this conditional use permit. We're not trying to mitigate any issues on this one. But do you have any questions for me?
If there's no questions, we can move to a motion or a discussion.
Chair, I'll move that the Planning Commission approve the conditional use permit for an over 30 feet of driveway at 1025 South Plum Tree Court with no conditions.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Tucker. And do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And it passes. Looks really beautiful. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Jeff. I'll email you.
All right, and we will move to agenda item 5, consideration of the site plan approval for Pharrell Gas at 95 East Union Avenue. Mr. Johnson as the applicant, and Mackenzie.
All right, so we have Cal Johnson in attendance in person here with us, and then the owner of this property, Mike Warren, is joining us via Zoom. So both of them are here if we have any questions. This location recently came through for a subdivision, if you recall. It's called Union Court, where we had two existing parcels, and the one that is 95 Union Avenue wanted to purchase the back half of 25 Union Avenue. It's about 1.5 acres that they purchased. We're back for the site plan of this. Today, they brought in their Mylar to get everything recorded, which we will be doing right away, but in the meantime, we're working on this side of things. So this is just for what is now 95 Union Avenue, zone manufacturing distribution. You can see here on the aerial that the back half of the property is already used for outdoor storage of trucks and trailers. They don't store any sort of propane gas or anything like that. That is what the business does. They're propane distributors. They plan to improve this entire property by actually creating drainage, because historically the area that they bought, that is in green right now, you can see as just a grassy kind of weeded area, has been acting as stormwater retention detention for decades and decades, and it has not been functioning well. I've heard it called a mosquito breeding facility. So it's a rough little area. This site plan will allow them to create a retention pond that is shared between 25 Union and 95 Union, and that's shared per the plat, and that is the really big detention pond. You can see where that existing grassy area is. And then they're also improving down by the street a new retention pond to make sure they are up to code with our retention standards by the engineering guidelines and the federal guidelines. They're still working with engineering on getting those calculations right up to where they need to be, but we're all confident that they will. So we are recommending that this is approved with the condition of planning and engineering red lines once again. As far as my red lines go, I really don't have any aside from potentially anything you guys put on this. So the area in question will be surfaced with more of like a dustless gravel, which is what is already in existence there. That's compliant with code for surfacing. There's no new buildings being proposed, so we don't have to worry about any sort of massing guidelines or architectural standards. The only thing I am unsure about and would like your guys' feedback on is currently there is 0% landscaping on really any of the parcels along this street. It's very industrial. There's no neighboring residential properties, that kind of thing. So what the applicant has requested, I guess, is with those detention ponds, he is wanting to just put a gravel. If you guys feel like you need to have some sort of like green vegetation, that kind of thing, it would be possible to potentially require them to do a certain percentage of the lot with landscaping. We as DRC and that group didn't feel that it was necessary at this location just because they are not really seen, it wouldn't be used, that kind of thing. But it's ultimately up to you guys because code in this area requires that there is 15% landscaping of the entire lot, except where reduced by the Planning Commission during site plan approval in support of water conservation, enhanced landscaping is concentrated within the front setback and not necessary for buffering. So I would like your feedback on that. I did talk to the applicant. He's willing to do whatever it takes to get this through. But other than that one little landscaping detail, the DRC is recommending approval.
Thanks, Mackenzie. Does anyone have feedback on landscaping?
I would agree with the DRC. I don't think in this particular circumstance that it in landscaping adds anything. Certainly we, you know, don't need to spend water on landscaping that's really not adding. It's not creating anything that that the community really needs. So I have no concern whatsoever with no landscaping in this particular instance.
Thank you, Commissioner Jorgensen. Anybody else have input on the landscaping?
Maybe it's the seat, but because we are making modifications to the frontage with a proposed retention basin, I would be in favor of, because there is modifications at the street level to at least some greenery trees, doesn't hurt any of us and follows the 15%, but like I said, it could be the seat.
The applicant, I was trying to problem solve ahead of time just because I knew that you guys might require this. He said it would, and I talked to the engineering department as well, as far as the function of that retention basin, the city engineer said that it would be acceptable to put some sort of like ground cover in there that maybe doesn't require as much water, more of like a native type plant, but just to bring some green to the area that would be easily maintained and would still allow that retention to function the way it needs to. And the applicant did indicate to me again that he was at the point where he would just do whatever it took to get this through. So just keep that in the back of your mind.
If they did that to the retention pond, would it get them to the 15%?
No.
They'd still be below.
I haven't done the calculation, but just based off the lot size and things like that, I don't know that it would be necessary to do it on the back retention pond just because it's not visible, but the front one is so tiny that, I don't know, Cal, what? How much do you think that would be?
Yeah, the little one out front is probably maybe 5-6% of the entire area of lot 95.
Thank you.
Reiterate just for the minutes, the applicant has stated that it's maybe 5-6% of the entire area.
I just have a question about this, Commissioner Stone. So there's like these railroad tracks right here. So is the property line going, hitting the tracks, or is it? Oh yeah. So the view from any street is actually not. I mean, like, can you see this area from any street?
No.
Really? Because Main Street's like over on the side. You can't. Can you see it from I-15?
You can maybe. No, I don't think so. I think it's too high. You can maybe see it from 2600, but I don't know how long you'll be able to see it from 2600.
Well,
because
it seems like it's kind of far from 2600.
The GE, it is. The GE building that's on the lot to the north is currently, either up for sale or under contract, and we've had people coming to us with development plans or potential ideas. So I don't see it being visible from any public right-of-way ever.
Okay.
And I think that rail line that is right to the north is more of a spur, and I don't know that it's even really used. I think it's actually maybe, isn't it a dead line possibly?
Yeah, it's an abandoned spur line. It's not used anymore.
So it's not like the front runner is going
Across
it.
Okay. In terms of landscape, I feel like if you can't see it from a public access point, it's like I feel neutral about landscaping.
And my comment was just solely based around because they're doing retention pond work up front.
I might suggest that the retention pond up front, rather than having live vegetative material, could be done with a different couple of different textures of rock mulch, and visually it would add some street appeal. But there's not really a lot of room. If they were building a whole new building and we were doing regular parking and parking islands and stuff, that would be opportunities for landscaping. But just to meet a number to put landscaping back in the back, just to meet that number, is probably wasteful of water and wasteful of resources for this applicant. And I think that's where the DRC was coming from. So my suggestion would be that if they did a couple of different decorative rock types in that front detention basin, that it would be appealable. Because if you look along the frontage of the property to the east, they did some different kinds of rocks there and xeriscaping with very little plant material, and it is nice, so it can look nice without plant material.
Right.
Thanks, Sherry. How does that sound to you, Commissioner Holbrook? The decorative mulch in the retention pond, or you still feeling like you want vegetation in there?
He's channeling his inner Commissioner Moss.
You want to go sit over there?
The power is strong right here. No, that would be acceptable. Just like I said, you're building a new retention basin, a retention basin that has some green and a retention basin that doesn't. I mean, green seems great. But I think it's all acceptable.
So just so you guys know, if you do require the green or the decorative rock, I would maybe say, Sherry, do you think like designed mulch with variations? Like, how do you feel?
I think I would just say the use of two different colors of rock mulch.
A minimum, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you guys do want either vegetation or the colored mulch, you need to make that a condition.
To be the bad guy, I mean, we're decorating up propane tanks and concrete, right?
Not true. The mulch? Do you want to talk? Do mulch?
Well, I just mean like let's go around and see if we want the mulch condition in there before it has mulch.
All right, let's start with you, Commissioner Stone. We're talking about decorative mulch and xeriscaping in the retention.
I'm neutral.
Pond.
I don't care.
That is no.
You called for a vote.
Well, I want to know where everyone else is.
That's why I started with
Let's start with Commissioner Jorgensen.
Okay, fine. Commissioner Jorgensen, how do you feel about decorative mulch?
I stand by my original comments. No, in this particular location, I don't think it's adding any value. I really don't.
Currently have gravel there?
We currently have gravel there now.
Oh, okay. Thank you. All right, Holbrook.
So that entire area that is already graveled, that's we actually already have a retention there from when we built a building a long time ago that the city required, and so it's already all graveled right now.
Okay.
Well, so it must look really nice because we haven't got any complaints.
Since we're going around, the applicant has swayed me because it's already there. I thought we were making a new retention pond. The gravel that's there is fine with me.
All right, Holbrook and Commissioner Ward.
I wouldn't require any.
Okay. And Commissioner Tucker already spoke.
I'm with Bill.
This is the bad guy. And now we're to you, Commissioner Stone.
I would not make that a condition.
All right, so that sounds like we are ready for a motion.
I'll make a motion. I move that the Planning Commission approve the site plan for the Feral Gas Outdoor Storage Expansion located at 995 East Union Avenue with the following condition: completion of all engineering and planner red lines.
Thank you, Commissioner Ward. Do we have a second?
Commissioner Jorgensen, I second.
Thank you. Any comment on the motion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. And any opposed? And the motion carries. All right. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being here online and for your input, and we hope things go well.
Thank you very much.
All right, and now we are moving to agenda item 6, the work session draft code amendments, title 13, chapter 4, and title 13, chapter 5. Sherry.
Great. So just to briefly go over what some of the changes are, I thought we could just run through it, and then if you have questions or red lines or changes that you'd like to see the ordinance, you can give those to me tonight, or if you want to still digest them for 2 more weeks, you can come back and we can give the rest of them, you know, give them to me in 2 weeks. And at the end of this presentation, I'll kind of go over our schedule of getting through all the chapters for the subdivision ordinance, because I have that all drafted up. Okay, so chapter 4 is our process for minor subdivisions. So this would be a process for subdivisions that are 10 lots or less. They would not require Planning Commission review. For these ones, they have to have no new dedication of streets. So, and I'm going to show you a couple examples of what might qualify for this minor subdivision. They have to be adjacent to an existing public street with utilities. They have to have no extension of new streets or utilities to be a minor subdivision. They can't be traversed by an area where we've shown on our general plan that a new street should be, because that would be one that would need to go through a major subdivision plan review. They have to conform to the general character of the neighborhood, so basically be a single family in a single family neighborhood, not adversely affect the remainder of the parcel or any adjoining or the adjoining parcel, and conforms to all the provisions of the ordinance, dedicates utility easements just like any other subdivision would, and cannot be located in a sensitive lands area, cannot have geologic hazards, cannot have slope, has to be something easy. So those are the types of subdivision that would qualify for. Under the new state code, conceptual plan is not required. It is allowed under state code if the developer requests it, and thus we're encouraging it in this for this, that people have a concept plan review with staff just to go over what all the rules were and make sure they have a good complete application when they filed their minor subdivision. So I wanted to show you, Okay, so I wanted to show you like an example. And this is just a property that I looked at at random. There's no reason why I selected or didn't select it, but this is just east on Center Street. Nobody's been in and asked about this. There isn't any plans. I don't want anyone to see this in the minutes and look at this and think, oh my gosh, somebody's trying to divide my property. This was just an exhibit, and it was a nice piece of property that I could show. So this is a piece of property that's just east of the church up here on Center Street. It is a 1.66 acre parcel. It has a single family home on it. It has 362 feet of frontage. It's in the R110 zone. It's on an existing street. With this particular property, I looked at it and went, well, if I were owner of this property and I wanted to develop it and give my 3 kids a lot, this is how I would do it. And so with 80 feet of frontage being the minimum standard and 10,000 square feet in the zone being the minimum, you could potentially divide this property into 4 lots. So this would be a property that would qualify for a minor subdivision. There's no new street dedication. There's already a sidewalk built. The only thing that would need to be bonded for would be the service connections, the laterals. So they would have to get into the street to put the laterals to the water and the sewer. But other than that, those are really the only utility extensions that we need to happen on this property in order to subdivide it. And so this would be a candidate for a minor subdivision. There are not a lot of properties in the city that would qualify as minor subdivisions, but there are a good number of them that someday could possibly. And so I looked at a few other ones just to see. For instance, this one up in the upper left-hand corner, that's a lot that's over on Odell Lane. If somebody wanted to tear down that house, they could possibly divide that into 2 lots. maybe three, but probably just two. I didn't do any measurement on it. At the corner of Center and Orchard on the northeast corner, there's a home that could possibly be divided into two lots. Over on Main Street, just north of 350 North, there's a parcel that has a house on it. They did a plan district on it a few years ago, but they never filed the subdivision. Actually, it wasn't a plan district. It was just a townhome development, but the developer never filed the plat. And so their approvals expired under the R17 zone. So right now it's just a single family home on like an acre. So that has the potential. It could be divided into two lots. Over on 850 West, Mr. Blundell's property, next to Sycamore Grove, if he wanted to tear down his house, that could be divided into two lots. Now, if they, like on Blundell's, if he wanted to do more than the two lots, it would not be a minor subdivision because he would be building a street to get back into additional lots in the back. And so only under certain circumstances would it qualify as that. But I wanted to just give you an example of what kind of properties this would apply to. And again, there are very few of these in the city, but there's a good handful that this would be a process that we would be sending somebody through that would be a very easy way for them to divide a lot off for their kids. It's provided in state law that we can provide this process for minor subdivisions for these type of subdivisions less than 10 lots on existing streets. My clicker stopped working. The whole thing stopped working. Okay, well, I'm just gonna keep going on. So the other sections in the minor subdivisions, some of them are just standard language, like the applicability, the provisions in this section only apply to minor subdivision. I spoke to you about the conceptual plan that is not required under state code, but it is encouraged. And I think I've got to change that heading from conceptual plan required to conceptual plan review or something like that. The section 50 describes minor subdivision applications. So, oh, there we go. So let me go back one or two. Oh yeah. So section 40 in this goes over what, no wait, where this is chapter 5. Right here. Okay. Sorry. So section 50 goes over what needs to be shown in the application. Section 60 talks about the development review, specifically how it's processed under the state code. We have 15 days after we have a complete application to get our first review to the applicant. And we're only allowed to go through a total of four reviews on subdivisions, four review cycles. Minor subdivisions really wouldn't go more than two reviews unless there was some reason that their engineer just refused to correct the errors or the red lines that we sent. It talks about how the administrative land use authority would be the CD director and how I would be responsible for coordinating the review from the other development review staff, the city engineer and city attorney. And I would have to have those approvals before I approved it. If I disapproved a minor subdivision plan for some reason, they would have the ability to appeal that decision to the Planning Commission. So that gives an outlet for that so that I can't usurp my power in this minor subdivision review. But if for some reason I was like, nope, you can't meet the standards and they wanted to appeal that, then they could appeal that to the Planning Commission. This gives an expiration of the final approval for 6 months after it's been approved, and they can get one extension if it's warranted for some reason, that they just couldn't get their ducks in order to get the Mylar recorded. The bond agreement, again, just as I mentioned before, there would be limited bonding for this one, but if they did need to install any infrastructure like stub in water and sewer, that would be the things that they would be bonding for. The plat requirements basically goes through and is saying that you still have to have on the minor subdivision plat everything that we have on a final plat in a regular subdivision. So it still has to offer all the meets and bounds descriptions, all the lot descriptions, all the addressing and the title blocks and everything like that have to meet the same standards that we have in Chapter 5 for final plats, and then talks about having to have that title report required prior to the attorney approving and the plat being recorded. So any questions on minor subdivisions or corrections that you want to give me today?
Can we?
I look at Ron immediately.
Can we look at the specific language? Like,
yes.
I want to make a comment about Section 13-4-20 and then Paragraph H.
Okay.
Geohazards, imagine that, me bringing that up. But anyway, we can look at that language. But anyway, so, you know, these minor subdivisions can be approved subject to the following conditions. And, you know, basically this talks about, you know, being within the sensitive lands overlay zone, which is a map, or subject to known or reasonably suspected geologic hazards. So the first example you gave is the one that's just below Valley View. And I think that's an interesting example, because I suspect that it's in the surface fault rupture zone for the Wasatch Fault right there.
And it very well may be. I didn't even look at that, but so that would be a reason that it would be, that would not be eligible for.
Yeah, but I think what it reinforces to me is just the fact that, rather than be somewhat ambiguous, it would be nice to have more than just the steep slopes reflected in this sensitive maps overlay, so that if we decided that, you know, I think fault rupture zones or susceptible slide areas like around Spring Hill or whatever, those type of hazards that we want to point out would be flagged, and to be no ambiguity about whether it's known or suspected. But anyway, I just continue to feel like we really need to look at all of the relevant geohazards, maybe not some of the secondary ones like radon gas, but the state has that map out there, and I suspect that particular example, because it came up with that subdivision that we processed a couple years ago on Orchard Drive up by Eaglewood Drive,
Buner.
And it was kind of an all-in-the-family thing, and they seemed to know about the geohazard risk, and they seemed to accept it, and it didn't seem like a big deal to them. But again, I just don't think we ought to end up with a situation where something could be, you know, left to chance, or it becomes a buyer beware type of situation.
So you just want some more explicit language.
Well, I think this language is fine,
okay.
But I still come back to that I do think it's time that we update this sensitive overlays map and we address the other geohazards beyond just steep slopes.
Agreed. And I actually have that on the last slide on my schedule, too.
And as long as I have my mic on, I'll give you just a couple of editorial corrections. I won't do that. But the last part on recording the plat, in the other section in the major subdivision, it's clear who does that, but who actually records the plat with the county? Who's responsible for that?
It's the city recorder.
City recorder.
That.
Okay.
So we can add that. It's the city and recorder delivers.
Other than that, it was just a couple of really minor typographical things.
Yeah, we have the city recorder deliver all of the plat maps to the county. And we don't want them to change after we've got all the signatures. We want to make sure that the exact same thing goes to the county, that nobody has tampered with it. I've never had that experience happen, but also we just are always the one responsible to do that. Yeah, the city recorder or designee, another city employee for sure. Okay, any other thoughts, concerns, typos?
Thank you so much for all the work on this. It looks great, and it's so much clearer.
Oh, good. Okay, so you want me to move on to Chapter 5? Okay. So Chapter 5 is our big chapter. It contains for our regular subdivisions, and it contains both the preliminary plat and the final plat requirements. So as we went over a few months ago, the changes to state code, the way that the new subdivision enabling legislation is written, that the preliminary plat, they have to establish a administrative land use authority. And for a preliminary plat, that can either be staff or it can be the Planning Commission. And then for final plat approval, it can only be staff. At no level can the City Council review subdivisions because they're administrative in nature. And so basically when we get to final plat, we've addressed any issues with the Planning Commission, but then final is just crossing the T's and dotting all of the I's and making sure they meet the standards. And so I just want to make that perfectly clear. Now, that doesn't, when we're doing a legislative change for like a P district, the Planning Commission and City Council are still going to see all of those. So that doesn't change any legislative decision. And even when we, and so when we do a P district, we're doing a development agreement, and that's approved by the City Council. So just with that caveat, understand that these are for standard subdivisions. And also, I don't think there's a lot of property left in the city for standard subdivisions, as it happens to work out. These are also would apply to any industrial or commercial subdivisions. So every commercial and industrial subdivision is still going to come through this process, as well as residential subdivisions. Okay, so in the first section, just as the purpose statement, you know, that this process is for those subdivisions that are not deemed minor subdivisions. State code does not require that we hold a pre-application meeting under Section 20, but what it does require is that when the applicant asks for a pre-application meeting, the city staff has to give them a pre-application, and it has a pretty extensive list of what we have to provide during those pre-application meetings. So it's basically a list of all the codes and all the standards and specifications and any rules and regulations that might apply to a subdivision. We have to have those available, any checklists for the applicant. Section 30 talks about what the application and the fees would be. So there's an application form, and it talks about the size of the plan documents, how we determine the complete application, and that requires, actually state code now requires, that once we've deemed the application as complete, we have to send written notice to the applicant, so that's when that clock starts ticking on our first review cycles. So the state code will allow us to have up to 4 review cycles. The city attorney is advising that you put 2 review cycles at preliminary plat and 2 review cycles at final plat. If you want to do 3 review cycles at preliminary and 1 at final, you could do that, but it seems like that doesn't make any sense. The other thing that's great about the way the state code is written is that when you go through the review cycle, if we give the applicant a list of red lines and corrections that need to be made, if they don't address every single thing on that list, the review cycle is not complete and they cannot move on to the next review cycle. So I think that takes that worry out of having enough review cycles. There is the possibility that we may not need the second review cycle unless substantive changes are made between the first review cycle and the second review cycle. In theory, we should have all of the corrected documents at the very beginning, and then we should be able to give them red lines on all of those things. Those red lines should come in addressing all those things, and there shouldn't be anything new that we didn't see before that needed to be reviewed. Unless it was, hey, you didn't give us this plan and profile, but at that point, we also wouldn't have had a complete application. So I'm trying in my mind to figure out how you would use the second review cycle, but I think it might be something like, oh, you know, you have 93 lots in this subdivision and 8 of them don't meet the minimum standards. So one of the corrections is to remove 8 of the lots. Well, now you've reviewed 8 of the lots. And so now we do have to re-review some of the lots for closures and things. And we could catch errors in that second review cycle, but it would be something like that. As part of the application, our first review is required within 15 days after we provide notice of that complete application. A conceptual plan will be required for any commercial, industrial, and multifamily developments or sensitive lands areas. So a conceptual plan can be required for those things. Conceptual plan review cannot be required for single family, two family, or townhome developments. And then geologic hazards review are required for areas in the sensitive lands area before they submit preliminary plan. So if they haven't gone through their geologic hazard study and have an approved study, then they can't apply for preliminary plat, because those are things that have to be they have to do that study up front to know how to design the subdivision and design the engineering to address the concerns raised in the geologic hazard study. So the one thing that is very clear in state code is that we are not limited on the review cycles for subdivisions that are in geologic hazards areas, because that is not a perfect science. A lot of times you'll go through those those revisions numerous times with engineers as they come up with design solutions that address those geologic hazards, and they may have to continue, they may have to revise them three or four times for our geologic experts to be satisfied that they've addressed the hazard. So we aren't bound by the two cycle review on each level if they have geologic hazards. Section 40 talks about what needs to be shown on the preliminary plat and the preliminary subdivision improvement plans. So the scale, the various documents that are required, like the title report, proof of ownership or financial control of the property, letters from public agencies that provide water or sewer. So if this is not on city water, it's on South Davis water. We have to have a will serve letter that says, yes, we can provide water for the subdivision. Yes, we can provide sewer service for this subdivision. A phasing type line, a timeline, their draft protective covenants, if they're going to have common area or private roads. any agreements that they have with the budding property owners, a traffic report, depending on the type of subdivision it is, soils reports. If there's not geologic hazards, there's still soils reports. So there, it's kind of, if you have the geologic hazard study, that is a soils report. But if you don't need a geologic hazard study, there still is a soils report required. And then the requirements for what needs to be shown on the actual preliminary plat. So what the signature boxes look like, what the title block looks like, that kind of things are covered in 40. In section 50, it talks about the review of the preliminary plat, the two review cycles. Again, the initial review has to be within 15 days. One of the things that state code calls out is that when we do our review, we can't just send them the plat with red line comments on it. We have to, every red line comment, we have to say, you have to change this because section 13-5-70 says this, you know, that you have to have this width of a road or this type or this standards and specifications item number 427, whatever, requires this type of fitting on the piping. And we have to be very specific. And then not only can we not just send them the plat or the sheets with the red lines, we have to send a separate log in a Word document or other word processing document with a list that says, here's the 20 things that need to be corrected. And that way, they then when they submit their corrections, they have to submit that same document back that says, this is how we've addressed all 20 of these red lines corrections that you've given us. If they fail to address any of those comments, then they haven't completed the review cycle. Upon completion of those two review cycles, we should have a really good preliminary plat for the Planning Commission to review. So it will go to the Land Use Authority, who for preliminary plat is designated as the Planning Commission. Your action would be to approve the preliminary plat if you find that it's in accordance with the ordinances and regulations. It conforms to a concept plan, if applicable, if it had one. If it had a concept plan review, that the subdivision, creation of the subdivision doesn't create a financial hardship to the city. For instance, if it were something that had steep roads that we were gonna have to plow and it was a financial hardship to the city, then that would be a reason that we could deny it. Or if it had substantial environmental impacts and that you couldn't set any conditions to mitigate any of those issues, that would be a reason that you would deny it. And then once you've approved it, we're required to send an official notification to the applicant of approval, which we always do anyway. In our current process, we send an action letter that says, hey, the Planning Commission approved your item at this and such date. These were the conditions of approval. Here's the next step. So this is something state code's requiring, but something we already do. And then Section 80 gives an effect of the approval and preliminary plat. So we're saying, look, if you don't apply for your final plat within 12 months, it's expired and you have to start over. If you apply for an extension and there's reasonable circumstances like, oh, building costs skyrocketed and interest rates went way high and we need to have a little more time before we move on to final plat, that would be a reason that we would extend the approval for a year. Given, with the caveat, as long as no significant code changes have had happened in that time. Like, we wouldn't want to extend a preliminary plat approval if we did some major re-rate or change to our standards and specification documents. We only allowed before we allowed this kind of pipe. Now we don't allow that. We only allow this other kind of pipe. So sorry that your plat expired. You're going to have to start over, and now you're going to have to draw your plans in conformance to our adopted standards now, even if it's more money. And then Section 90 starts the final plat process. So again, it goes over the filing deadline, the application, and the fees within 12 months of preliminary approval. We're probably being redundant in that because I know we've said it in a couple of sections, but I want it to be very clear to developers that they need to keep things moving and not let things sit, because when they sit, we tend to forget that we even went through preliminary plat. We've been talking to Clifton Place with Brighton, and it's been a year since they had their preliminary plat. And honestly, both Mackenzie and I were like going, did they get preliminary plat or did we just do concept? And we had to go back and look at the minutes. And now that project's being resurrected, and they even got both properties back under contract. So before they had lost the contract on the north side, but now they have it back under contract. So it's coming for you. So in Section 110, it talks about the final plat and what needs to be shown on it. We're modernizing some of this language so that we don't require paper copies. Like our old ordinance said, 5 copies in paper, and we don't want paper copies anymore. We just didn't have everything electronically submitted. The title report needs to be brought an updated title report at this point at final plat. Then the things that the plat drawings have to have. Again, some of this is repetitive from Planning Commission or from preliminary plat, you know, what the plat size should be, the sheets, what the scale is, what the title block should say, the survey data that goes on there, dedication of street right-of-ways, the street names and the numbers and how to number them and how to number the lots and the public utility easements and the waterways and floodplains if they're applicable, all the lot dimensions, all of that good stuff. And then the city attorney would approve and review the plat with the title report. If they have common area ownership, they would have to show their articles of incorporation as well as their submit their homeowners association documents and their protective covenants, and then their final improvement plans or their construction drawings, and that's going through the same data that they need to show on that for the plan and profile sheets for all the civil engineering and the design of the waters, lines and utilities and streets. As far as the evaluation of the final plat would be, again, on this one, this community development director is designated as the land use authority for final plat. Again, the state code prohibits the planning commission or city council from being the final plat approval body. There will be 2 review cycles on this one. Same kind of rules, 15 days after complete application. They have a 20-day response time. They have to have the specific lists and respond to them. So same procedure as preliminary plat. Once that a complete application was in and we went through the review cycles, then as the administrative land use authority, the CD director would review it and make sure everything was done, verify that we had approval from the city engineer and the city attorney and any other applicable development review staff, and then, of course, any affected entities, and send notice to the public. So if we have a water design water drawings, we would need to make sure that, and it was South Davis Water, that they had reviewed the plans. We need to make sure that the sewer district has reviewed the plans and that they find them to be in conformance with their standards and specification. And then at that point, I would send notice to the applicant that it had been approved, and that would give them the authorization to print their final Mylar and submit all of the final documents, which would include the final title report, the easements or covenants that they may have, their storm water management agreement. And this is a new list in here. These are all things that we require right now, but now we're adding them into code section, because if we're going to require them, we need to have them specifically stated and listed out what it is they're required. So we require a storm water management agreement, a subdivision improvement agreement, a bond, payment of their applicable fees, payment of applicable impact fees for common area. That's one that we do right now. So impact fees are charged on the individual lots when they get building permits, but when we have developments that have common area that they're going to be installing landscape in, we require them at the time of plat that they pay those impact fees and connection fees. Otherwise, they don't tend to come back in and do that. So it's easier to get that done right at that stage before we record the Mylar, because they want to get the Mylar recorded. And then, of course, any other agreements that might be required by code, a development agreement, or by some other law. Then we would sign the Mylar, and the county or the city recorder would develop it, would deliver the Mylar to the county recorder, and then it has a final plat, would be void in 12 months if not recorded. Currently in our code, it specifically says like that the Mylar, the final plat, is void in like 6 weeks if it's not recorded, which is not realistic time frame, so we really don't enforce that. But we just don't enforce that, because it's not, we can't do that. It would not even be possible for them to get all of the documents together in 6 weeks. So this brings this to a much more reasonable time frame for the with 12 months. It gives reasons to when the final plat could be disapproved. It would basically be, you know, if they didn't correct all their deficiencies, or they for some other reason didn't have all the documents that they needed. Section 150 goes over the security bond. State code requires us to provide at least two methods of bonding and what needs to go into the bonding. So what state code allows us to do, we have to incorporate the plat and the improvement plans in that assurance document. We have to allow them 2 years to build that. We can only require a bond of 100% of the engineered estimated costs for the infrastructure. A lot of practices up until recently, cities would take 110%. You're only allowed to take up to 100%, and then you're allowed to retain the final 10% of the bond for the warranty period. You have to have a process in there for bond releases, so we've put that in there. Every 30 days, a developer can ask for a bond release for infrastructure that's been completed and inspected and accepted. It talks about a process of a bond deficiency if costs change or they take a long time building and they just don't have, the bond is not in the same amount as it should be for the development, what we would do in that. It talks about the developer performance failure and how the city would call the bond in and finish the infrastructure if they failed to install it. And again, the type of bond agreement that we would allow. So we allow a cash bond, a letter of credit, or a surety. We have to allow at least two of them, but we also have the right to reject a bond for the benefit of the city, because the bond is for us. And so if we feel like there's something wrong with that bond, if our attorney is like, hey, we know that this bond from this insurance company, and we have some information that they might not be reputable, or we may have some experience with them causing us difficulties in the past, we have the right to reject that particular bond, depending on who the entity is that's issuing it. And provides for an extension time for completion. And then in 160, we have a provision for a delay agreement. The city council could enter into an agreement to delay some of the installation of the infrastructure. It would have to be approved by the city attorney. For instance, an example of this would be maybe we were doing a phased development and phase 4 and 5 is going to require a new water tank. We're not going to require them. We could enter an agreement with them to say, we don't have to install the water tank until you are ready to build, you know, phase 4 and 5. We won't make you build the water tank for the first 3 phases of the development. That would be something that we would delay the installation of the infrastructure for some reason. And then 170 just talks about the city recorder recording the plat after all those items have been completed. What? Well, yeah, that's not how it's written in the code. I just wrote it that way on my staff report. So the city recorder would record it upon completion of all of those above items. Any questions on subdivisions? You want to talk about specific sections that you want to wordsmith better? Or?
Well, can I ask a question relative to section 40? So there's a standard on stormwater drainage, and it's about the sizing of the drain pipes and the storm drain detention basins. And the storm drain detention sizing criteria is a 100-year event. But I was surprised that the pipes were sized for a 10-year return event. Is that the current standard in the city? And I want to tell a story about that.
So what I'm going to tell you on this is that this is a mixture of our existing code. So some of these are not up to the current standard that our city engineer is going to tell me to change, but we haven't reviewed that yet with the DRC. So next Monday, the DRC is reviewing Chapter 4 and the first half of Chapter 5, and then the following Monday, they'll be reviewing the second section. And so I expect that this is a working draft still, and those numbers will be updated because she has not reviewed them,
That struck me as pretty lenient.
Yes.
And the story I want to tell is about our own subdivision in North Salt Lake, 13th hole of the Eaglewood Golf Course. There was a big rain event. It overflowed, came up through the inlet basin and right down into my big neighbor's basement. And so I think in that particular case, it required upsizing and replacement and all that. But I think bad things can happen. It's not, you know, not just that the streets and the gutters are full and there's ponds and things like that, but the water's going to find low points and it's going to sometimes find its way into people's basements. I've seen it happen. So anyway, that one just kind of jumped out at me. The 10 years seemed like a pretty lenient standard.
In number 19, yeah, and that's what is in our current code right now, and I know that's a number that she's going to update. And there's quite a few of these in here because they're just outdated. So in taking some of that older language and me not being an expert in those things and us trying to have we have limited number of planning commission meetings and limited number of DRC meetings, I have it all mapped out on a calendar to just get it adopted right before the deadline, which is February 1st of next year. So those are still under review.
No, that sounds great.
But I will circle them and
note
that you want the engineer to.
Another section I wanted to ask about was in section 60, and this is the administrative land use authority preliminary plat. In the code language under 260 lines 267 to 277. Anyway, talks about the things that the Planning Commission could do, but it really gets into the nitty-gritty of soils, slopes, and drainage characteristics and all these types of things. The reality of it is that the Planning Commission doesn't take an independent review and decide at that level of detail. We would be extremely reliant on the development review staff, and I would like the language to maybe reflect that that's input that, you know, ultimately the Planning Commission's acting as the administrative land use authority and can impose that, but we really need help from the development review staff, the city engineer in particular, with stuff like this, you know, because I don't know about you all, but I'm not going to be getting into the nitty gritty of the grading plans and all that.
Yep. And so that's existing language, and I have a note on my copy for the DRC that says, Karen, do we need this? Is this the right way? Is this written the right way? Because I also didn't feel like it was written the right way in our current code. And so I'm glad you pointed that out, but that you're exactly right. I didn't feel good about that language in particular either, because I was like, you don't have the expertise, and by the time we get to preliminary plat, we should have already solved all of those problems for you. But if we feel like we've identified some problem that those, we need a condition because of that problem, then that's going to be upon the recommendation of the city engineer to the planning commission.
And then just along the lines of editorial comments, this is really great. I think it's very comprehensive and don't have much to offer, but there were at least one instance where there's an abbreviation used, UGCP. I don't know what that is. I thought I knew government acronyms, but I don't know what that
line
was. It's line 171. I'm not sure what that is. But anyway, I would just suggest that we spell that out. If that's the Utah Geologic Central Planning Committee, I don't know, whatever it is. Spell it out, because it wasn't clear to me what it was. Anyway, again, compliments. I think it's a great document. I don't mean to be nitpicky.
Nope, I like it. That's why we want your review as well.
Commissioner Jorgensen doesn't mean to be nitpicky. I don't mean to be devil's advocate. Two review cycles. When it sounded like getting to two would be difficult when the state allows four, why is it two instead of four?
So the state allows four total. So there's two at preliminary plan and two at final plan. So that was what our city attorney was recommending. And he's the representative from the Utah League of Cities and Towns. So he did a whole thing for all the planners, a Zoom webinar, where he said, I'm recommending all my clients, which we are one of his clients, to put two of those review cycles at preliminary plat and two of those review cycles at final plat.
That's understood.
So that's where the four comes in.
Okay. Sometimes we, in submitting to a city, you'll get a comment of, this requires a flux capacitor. And you respond and say, well, those don't exist. And then you get a response that says, well, have you seen a DeLorean? And then you respond and say, well, no, that doesn't exist either.
So yeah.
That was, okay.
So I suspect that this is put into state code because there are some cities out there that do that very thing. I don't think that we do. At least we don't do it on purpose. I've never asked for a flux capacitor. But I understand completely why it's there. I feel like what they, rather than just saying, hey, you get four review cycles, and then, so I feel like the state code, when it was negotiated on how the changes to subdivision ordinance were going to be written, I feel like the Home Builders Association said, hey, we only want no more than four review cycles, and then the city side, Utah League of Cities and Towns, went, well, okay, but we want to say, here's all of the things that are wrong with it, and we'll tell you where they are in all the codes, but if you don't address every single one of those things in that, then that review cycle doesn't move to the second. So I feel like that was the compromise in saying, well, we're only going to limit you to four review cycles, but then the city is saying, well, okay, if we only get these one bite of the apple, then we're going to say, you better have everything addressed or tell us how you're addressing every single comment. And if you fail to address even one comment, you don't get to move on to the next review cycle. So it seemed like a fair compromise for those cities that are good actors and something that will help those cities that aren't being good actors to be better actors in the review of subdivisions. So we all hear the horror stories, even though they don't tell us who the cities are that are bad actors. We always want to know.
Tell us, Sherry, who are
they? I don't know. They don't tell us. We're like, tell us who they are. Maybe we can go help them. Maybe they need more staff. Maybe they need us to advocate to their council that they need more review staff. You know, we never can find out from the Home Builders Association who it is, because they don't want to, they say they don't want to have a bad relationship with these cities, but I think they already have bad relationships with them. And yeah, that's kind of my feeling, but we're like, okay, well, if that's what we got to do, then this is what makes it fair for the people who are not being unfair to developers. So I know that there are cities that aren't fair to developers, and on the other side of it, I know that there are developers that cut corners, and so I think that's what the new legislation is trying to fix, so that everybody is playing on the same level playing field, hopefully. Any other comments? Okay. So I will just go on to review what our schedule is going to be for the next few Planning Commission meetings. At your next Planning Commission meeting, I plan to have the PUDs and condominium chapter ready for you, as well as the chapter on plat amendments. I do have them drafted already. I just have to update them with the different standards for the new subdivision ordinance or statute. So I feel like this schedule is totally doable. And then on the 24th of October, doing Chapter 8, which is the general requirements for all subdivisions. So that goes into, well, the maximum length of a street of a cul-de-sac is 600 feet. The maximum slope of a, you know, those kind of rules. And then Chapter 9 is the standards for the essential improvements. So that talks about, you know, the civil stuff, the really boring engineering stuff that a few of you will be able to understand much better than me. On the 28th of November, plan to do a final review of all of the chapters together. So that'll be the one, you know, our chance to bring any final corrections to those, go over the table of contents. And then on December 12th, look at the changes to Chapter 3, which will be amendments and rezones, and the changes to Chapter 7, which is conditional uses. That's not the individual conditional uses in the commercial zones that we have the whole list we need to do. That comes a little bit later, but how conditional uses are processed, because parts of our subdivision ordinance right now are in three different places. They're in Chapter 3, they're in Chapter 7, and so by pulling all of the subdivision stuff out into its own Title 13, we have some holes in those other sections that we need to patch up just to make them function the way they're supposed to be. So we'll do those two chapters, and then we'll plan on having the public hearing at your first meeting in January, and a recommendation hopefully that night at the to go to the City Council the following week, because the City Council meetings in January will be January 2nd and January 16th, and the code has to be adopted by statute by February 1st, and so it has to be adopted by January 16th. If we could go faster, I would, but I just don't think we have the capacity for that, or I don't have the capacity for that, and the DRC doesn't have it. I've scheduled all of the DRC meetings out with them. I've given them a very strict schedule so that we can stay on task with the internal review. The city manager gave all the department heads a pep talk today about staying up on reading the codes that I'm giving them and giving me feedback, because that's one of the hardest things for me to get from the other departments is their feedback on boring codes. But he expressed how important it was for them to read all of these codes and get us corrections for anything that they see that are issues. That leads me into, once we have finished the subdivision ordinance, there are the other code updates that I have on my plate, on my to-do list for next year. We have to work on the conditional uses in the commercial and industrial zones. Those are the big list ones. We have to update our sign code. I think that there are some holes in there, and I don't want to get some of those really, really big signs that I won't say their name because it's a four-letter word on some of the streets that don't make sense. So I really want to plug some of those holes before a Pandora's box opens. Updates to the geohazard ordinance. I've talked to the city engineer about it. She has the same concerns that Commissioner Jorgensen has about covering all of the geohazards, and she has some issues now that she's been working really closely with the geohazards ordinances and doing the studies with the developers and property owners for retaining walls, that she needs some things that need to be refined a little bit. The building official brought a small correction to me with regards to accessory building setbacks that needs to be changed. That would be a really quick change, just so that we're in conformance with state code. City Council wants us to look at the water-wise landscaping and think about park strips again, and should we or should we not require any vegetative material in it? That question still keeps coming up. We have some updates that we'll need to do to short-term rentals. Specifically, We have short-term rentals that are allowed in single-family homes, and it requires owner occupancy, but we also have some apartments that are renting as short-term rentals, and so we need to talk about whether or not we want to allow that. For instance, right over here on the corner, there's like 8 apartments in this, and the owner of the property is renting 3 of those units full-time. Well, nobody ever, I mean, it's never his permanent residence, but we haven't specifically allowed that. And so it's something that we need to think about if we want to allow it. On some aspect, I don't think it does any harm. But we need to figure out how we want to handle that, because I don't want to run into a problem where we have so many of our dwelling units being rented as short-term rentals that we have housing shortages. And that happens in a lot of communities. We lost that again?
I don't know what's happening.
Sherry, did I hear you right that the current code for like single-family residences is that if it's a short-term rental, it has to be owner-occupied? It can't just simply be an Airbnb that's
right.
put up for rent?
They have to.
That they exist today in that form.
I know. Okay. They're supposed to be there. The owner is supposed to occupy it at least 180 days out of the year. Yeah, and I know we have some out there that are not, so we really need to think about that.
When you walk your dog every day, you can pick them out.
I know where a lot of them are. Some of them are in our new annexation area.
We have a lot of them in the city that are undocumented, because until like 2022, we weren't allowed to use Airbnb or VRBO listings for code enforcement to target these unregistered or unlicensed short-term rentals. And we've just continued the practice of not doing that, unless it's complaint-driven. If a neighbor calls and says they don't live here, they live in California, and they always have people parking up and down the street and are causing havoc in the neighborhood, then we're going to prompt the owner to come into compliance or stop using it as a short-term rental.
Yeah, so we had a couple of those. We had one that was using...
Well, that's exactly the circumstance, and it's parking on the street.
Yep.
So you know,
renting them to
big during the winter,
groups.
When they shouldn't be parking
so
there.
So I permit these. I want to know what just happened. Never mind. We'll do that later. I permit these, and the biggest things that hold them up, whenever people call and say, are they easy to get the permits, it's do you meet safety requirements per building code, so like water heater strapped to the wall, window egress, that kind of thing. Do you have enough parking off the street, and are you owner occupied? And those three things are what kill short-term rentals from being licensed. Everything else is easy. So,
and it doesn't necessarily, it drives some of them underground rather than make them bring into compliance. But on the other side of it, we have a lot that we know we don't get any complaints about. They operate just fine and they're no problem. It's those owners that operate them and will rent them out to, 15 guys that are coming into town for a college reunion and they're going to have a big party. They were actively marketing the Airbnb as a reception center, as a destination wedding.
I'm not saying it was on Scenic Hills, but I'm totally saying it was, and that road is real thin.
And I might that might be the one that I've walked my dog by.
They were like parking them down at the park and then shuttling the guests up to the house and packing every weekend with hundreds of people. And the cars lined up, and it was a huge disruption to the neighborhood. So we were able to bring a stop to the reception center part of that, because that was just, it was terrible for the neighborhood. I wouldn't want it in mind. And then any other code changes that the legislature thinks up for us to change in the next legislative session. And I'm sure just as I get the subdivision ordinance changed, they'll have revised it, and we'll have to do some other change to it. I just anticipate that there'll be something they want us to change after that. But that's what's on our plate for code amendments. So we're going to be busy with... On top of all of that, I think I have it I think I meant to go back and put that in there. But on top of all of that, I have just finished the RFP for our general plan update. So we'll be starting the general plan update. We should be getting that RFP out. The city manager is reviewing it right now so we can get that sent out and get a contractor selected. So that will be on our plate, as well as we're submitting a letter of interest for a TLC grant to hire a consulting firm to do some urban design and architectural work for us to kind of give us some urban standards, much like a form-based code, but maybe not call it that, and actually design specific name blocks in the town center. So we want them to look at this whole triangle area and the 130 East area and say, okay, if this was redeveloped, this is what the building massing should be like. Councilmember Knowlton wants us to say, like, okay, maybe a shared parking garage makes sense for those 130 East properties that would be in the middle of this. So maybe, you know, the RDA could purchase a piece of property and we could do some surface parking until the redevelopment of the other ones. You know, what kind of other ideas do we have? What would redevelopment look like on Highway 89 north of the town center right here at center on where all the car dealerships are? What would be the appropriate design that we're looking for along our other sections of Highway 89? So
Does North Salt Lake employ a grant writer? Who's writing the grant?
We do. Allie writes all of our grants.
That's wonderful.
And she's awesome. I've made presentations to the council where we've went through, and over her 12, 13 years she's worked here, she's brought in over, like, I think the last figure was like over $11 million
That's
in
awesome.
Grant money. So she's so cool. Phenomenal at getting us grant money. So we're working on that. We're working with the city engineer on a corridor preservation agreement with UDOT for what the cross sections should look like through the town center. We're working on a capital facilities plan for trails, because that's one of the things, like, we have this active transportation plan, but we don't have a capital facilities plan to implement the active transportation plan items. And so we're going to have a five-year plan that says, okay, each year city council is going to, you know, they'll decide we're going to put X number of dollars towards projects for active transportation. So bike lanes, protected bike lanes, buffered bike lanes, trails, side paths, some of these cool projects that we have in our active transportation plan. So We're definitely not just sitting in the office playing solitaire on our computers. We have a really full plate.
We know.
It's impressive, and we do appreciate the professionalism of North Salt Lake staff. It's really remarkable with all the work that you do. Can you set a little expectation about the general plan update? Is it geared towards process in contractor selection? Is it geared towards a bold new vision? Is it geared towards a reiteration of what the public said it wanted in the last plan update? But could you frame that a little bit
for
us?
So I think it's an update of the vision to make sure that the vision is still the same, or revise the vision, right? Kind of update what the vision is for the general plan and for the town center master plan, to bring all of the other documents, all these different plans together under one umbrella. So let's take all the things that we've said in the active transportation plan, let's take it all the things that we've said under the town center master plan, and let's put them in one cohesive document that addresses what our current vision is. So there'll be a big public process. We will have input, we'll do visioning sessions, we'll establish a stakeholder steering committee, as well as then various public processes. And what we're putting out in the RFP basically is saying, look, these are all the things we want you to cover. Tell us how you would do it. Tell us what you would do. And then we expect to get, I mean, like when we put out the RFP for the Hatch Park design, we got 8 different proposals with 8 different perspectives on how they would involve the public and how they would get to our big idea, whatever the big idea is going to be in the park. And so we want them to take all of these things and analyze them, and then go back out and see, okay, is our vision still the same? Is our vision with the public still the same? So it's really going to be driven fight by public input and try to bring everybody to the table that wants to participate.
That sounds great. I look forward to seeing how that goes. I watched with interest as kind of a casual observer what Bountiful City did with theirs, and you could offer your critiques on it. It seemed like it was more like, you know, pay between the numbers kind of public input, these are our zones, and these are the kinds of things that you might have in that zone. Which one do you, I mean, the public meeting that I went to is, well, which one do you like the looks of the best? Well, I didn't really quite get that, because at the end of the day, the city doesn't prescribe, you know, all the architectural and massing standards. They have some standards. But anyway, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
I like, you know, what you said, and I look forward to seeing more about it.
We always like to set that bar really high and we like to do better than Bountiful. Just some friendly competition. Mm-hmm. We love our neighbors. We also like to...
like win.
Yeah. Did I say that out loud? No, she said it. Any more comments on this?
Thank you for all your work and the staff's work with the updating the language and the numbers and the consistency in keeping it moving and pacing some of these things. No pun intended, but you're great at that.
Did you get to keep your intern?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. City manager said I could keep her.
Nice.
So we have enough hours. Even in the original contract for 750 hours, we didn't even use half of the hours by the time school started for October. And so he said we could keep her till she graduates, and then we can talk about other options at that point if
cool.
she's willing to stay, and she said yes.
Oh, that's great.
So we're just thrilled to death to have her stay. And we have our new code enforcement officer, and he's doing amazing. So I think you're going to see great things happening in the city. Like if you notice when you're driving up Eagle Ridge Drive, you might notice some really old tattered development signs that are now gone.
Nice.
So I'm really excited about all of the good works he's doing. So
he's fresh.
He's proactive.
He's proactive, and he comes from a long line of code enforcement. How many years? 15?
14.
Yeah, and so he's just really experienced, and he's teaching me things, so
oh, cool.
It's wonderful. It was a weird training dynamic for a couple days.
That's
there.
Cool. Yeah. I introduced him to the city council last week, and I was telling him a little story about he got a complaint about a mattress that had been dumped behind the post office. And so he went over to the post office, and he went in and talked to the worker in there. And if you don't know the property that the post office, the federal government doesn't own that property. It's a separate property owner that leases the post office to the federal government. So he comes back in, and he's like, you know, it could take me a couple weeks to find a contact with this LLC and then send them a notice to come pick up this mattress. And they're like, who's responsible for removing this mattress? Because obviously the post office didn't dump it there, but it's on their property. And he goes, or I could just go and get it and throw it in the back of my truck and take it down to Public Works if you wouldn't mind. And I was like, if I wouldn't mind, are you kidding me? Absolutely. That's awesome. Thank you. And so he's just like that. He's just like, he sees solutions where he can be helpful, and he just goes and is going to make it happen. And I appreciate
the post office
dedication. Yeah, I guess somebody dumped a mattress in the dumpster at the post office, and then the people who come and pick up the dumpster threw it out of the dumpster because they can't put it in their truck, and so it was like, well, we just went and took it down. He just took it down to Public Works and put it in their big dumpsters, and it
I'd say we have the perfect community development team right now.
Yeah, so knock on wood, nobody's allowed to leave.
That's really cool.
Chain them all to their desks if they try to.
All right. Are we ready to move on to number 7? Report on City Council actions.
Yeah, so at the last City Council meeting, the plat amendment for Eagle Point Estates for Ronnie Price was approved. And the Hatch Park Design Services bid award was granted to G. Brown Design. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, we had 8 really great firms. And it was G. Brown did our original concept plan, and they were not in any way guaranteed that they were going to get that. We reviewed the 8 proposals. We had separate sealed bids for the actual dollar amount that they would charge. The committee went through and ranked all of the proposals, and we narrowed it down to 2. So the top 2 were G. Brown Design and EPG. EPG is the company that did Mill Creek Commons, a landscape architecture firm. And then we went and toured some of their projects. So we toured Mill Creek Commons, and then we toured several parks that G. Brown Design, we gave them each 2 hours to take us on a little tour and visit their thing. And then we came back and we debated back and forth. They both were really strong candidates. We liked one for their plaza design, and we liked one for their playground design, because G. Brown is really, really good at building unique playgrounds. And at the end of the day, G. Brown just came out on top. And so they're going to, we are going to start this project anew to get the new designs updated. They're going to help hire the general contractor, and they'll go on. I know you've probably seen the park plan on the concept plan. It might not look exactly like that, because we asked them point blank, are you absolutely married to this design? If the rec center is not going to be built there, can we, you know, we probably should be looking at what we want to do instead of a rec center. We want to talk about some parking and maybe some of the ideas that we learned from these other 8 applicants on some of the things that they did, and how we want to really look at the Hatch Park. So I'm super excited. That's also on our plate, is the Hatch Park rebuilt. So. But really, that's cool. Going to be getting started really soon, and we're excited to see that happen.
What's the time frame estimate on that?
So I think that G. Brown had the most realistic time frame, and they were saying that the park construction would be done by the fall of 2026.
Cool.
So it could go a little bit faster, and that was probably one of the comments that we were wondering if that timeline could be shortened up a little bit, if we could. Because like EPG's timeline was like 9 months, and we're like, that didn't seem realistic, and the other one was a little longer, so maybe somewhere in the middle, I think what we wanted to do. So that's what we're gonna work really closely with G. Brown on that. We're close to also having our draft of the town center market study, so. And then I just wanted to make you aware of the primary election results. If you hadn't already seen, these are the top 6 candidates, and that will be going on to the final election, and remind you that the election this year is on November 21st instead of November 7th. So, but that's where we stood, or where we stand with our 6 candidates. We eliminated 4.
And the APA conference is this week. And oh. Sherry sent you guys the parking area and also the updated agenda. So. Just a reminder.
Who all is going to that?
I'm going to half a day.
Nice.
I'm so glad we registered you.
I am looking forward to seeing all of you there then. That'll be fantastic. We'll miss Catherine, but we know what she's doing, something equally important and fun.
Okay, that's a good segue.
Yeah. But that is a good segue. We were wondering if the planning commissioners wanted to go in on a gift with us. We were thinking about giving them a gift card, and we just thought it might be a nice thing, you know, from all of us. Mackenzie's idea was to get like a DoorDash gift card.
She got me that for my wedding.
It's a great idea.
And it was just super nice to have on deck.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I was thinking. But I was just going to do it with Sherry, and she's like, well, her other friends might be interested, but no pressure. If you guys do want to contribute, just come see me. Or shoot me an email and we'll figure that out. I won't make it a big thing for you guys to all feel guilty for not wanting to.
I want to do it.
Okay, email me. Or Brianna, don't email me, because I need to talk to you anyways.
Yeah.
I have a plat for you to sign before you leave.
Okay.
So.
Awesome. I just wanted to talk about one city council item. In the last meeting, Councilmember Porter had expressed some concern and that he was troubled about us not understanding our role as the Planning Commission. So I just wanted to get some clarity and alignment around our role, specifically pertaining to the North Lofts as a P district. The comment that was made is that we are an administrative body and that we shouldn't be listening to the public. So just for our own benefit and for staff's benefit and for the council's benefit, I don't want to waste anyone's time. And so I would like some clarity on what our role is with the public hearing, if we are not meant to be using any of that information, some guidance around that, just to make sure that we are all in alignment and can feel like we're working together as a team with the council and the commission. And just wanted to ease any troubled minds or concerns that were coming from Councilmember Porter on that.
So I think what needs to be stated is that when you are doing a legislative act, when the application before you is a legislative decision and you're making a recommendation for the City Council, it's not a subdivision, it's not a conditional use permit. Those are administrative actions. But a change in the development agreement is in a P district is actually a legislative act because you're changing the regulations. And it's much like a zone change. And so I think it's important to be wary of public clamor. So sometimes we get the public that come and say things that really aren't substantive, to use a term that Commissioner Jorgensen used with me about some of our public comment. But I think that the public process, that you are supposed to listen to the public to those items that have substance. So if the public comes up and says, hey, we really have concerns about this parking on this zone change, I think that's something that you need to examine and address to find out if their comments are valid, if they are substantive. Sometimes you're going to have people that are always going to be, the sky is falling and any new development is bad. And I think that I'm going to give Councilmember Porter the benefit of the doubt on that what he was maybe perceiving was that some of those comments were comments that didn't have substance. And so at that point, when you get comments that are public clamor, that are the sky is falling and they really don't relate to, we just don't want more growth or we don't want more people that are those kind of people or low income people or things like that. And I think that you as a planning commission understand this, that you have to take those under advisement, but that doesn't mean that you have to vote no because the people say we don't want any more apartments. I think you understand your role as the planning commission and it's a balance. And great. So.
Thank you.
I appreciate you bringing that up.
I just wanted to clarify some of that because in the meeting, it kind of read to me that our role here was to either pass it as the project that was originally passed or as the project that was just the application in the idea that it's just an administrative item for us.
Yeah.
But my understanding of the P district was that there was more to it than that. And I just wanted to make sure that we were all in alignment and understanding that we're working hard to do our job correctly and understand the power that we hold as a planning commission, and we're not trying to usurp power or overstep our boundaries with that. We also don't want to hold anything up. So if those are the two options that we should be looking at, and we can pass it to the City Council and they can do a public hearing, we also want to waste nobody's time, including our own.
Yep.
So I just wanted to get a little bit of clarity and alignment on that. So thank you. I appreciate that.
And you guys always have the pleasure of hearing the whole spectrum of the public.
We sure
do. You've all been in those public hearings where people have made grandiose, weird conspiracy theory statements at this podium.
We've heard some things.
that we all have to go, where is that coming from? But then you have people that stand up and say, hey, we actually have a parking problem and we have this actual problem or we have this drainage problem. I mean, that's what a public hearing is for, is to wait through all of that public comment and determine which items are things that are relevant that we do need to address and those things that are not relevant that we get to educate the public on why we need a variety of housing or why we have a parking standard or why that parking standard should be this or why it should be that. So I think you guys are doing a great job.
Thank you. Appreciate that. And then we are on approval of minutes. We'll start with the joint work session with the City Council minutes. Are there any amendments to that or changes that need to be made? If there are none, we can do a motion.
Commissioner Jorgensen, make a motion that we approve the joint work session with City Council meeting minutes as drafted for the September 12th, 2023 joint session.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Thank you. And all in favor, say aye.
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 Okay, and then approval of the minutes from the regular meeting separately. Any amendments or adjustments? If not, a motion.
Commissioner Jorgensen, make a motion that we approve the meeting minutes as drafted for the September 12th, 2023 regular Planning Commission meeting.
Thank you. And do we have a second?
I'll second again.
Thank you. And all in favor? Aye.
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 And big thank you to Andrea for always cleaning that up and making it look so great. We appreciate all the work there. And we are adjourned.